Hey people, are you in the market to buy a new watch? Well, let me help you. As your luxury timepiece concierge, I will help you source, purchase, and get you the best possible price at no additional cost to you. I work with the best authorized dealers in the world who have almost every brand you can think of, from Rolex to Patek Philippe to every brand in between. And I advise you, guide you, and help you purchase something that you're going to have for a lifetime. Okay, on with the show. On today's episode, I talk to Vincent Fremont, the CEO of Art News. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
What's going on there, watch fans? I'm on the phone with Vincent Fremont, the CEO of Art News. How are you doing, Vincent?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this, and I appreciate it. I know you're a busy man, and my love affair with Warhol it keeps unfolding and surprises me in the most amazing ways. And
when did you start becoming interested in Andy?
I'm 40. I just turned 40 in January, so probably when I was about 17 or 18.
Great. Well, and I met Andy Warhol when I was 18, so.
That's pretty cool, man. And I know you met him, like, at a very pivotal sort of moment, right? Like, almost a year after his attempted...
Attempted assassination.
Yeah,
I met Andy in August of 1969. The attempted assassination by Valerie Solanas was June 1968, so it was a little over a year.
Wow, and obviously you had no prior, I mean, you didn't meet him until August of 69, so you wouldn't
but
have
I
known.
I was a fan of his and certainly aware of his work starting when I was around 12, because my father was an artist and showed with the Esther Robles Gallery in La Cienega, which was close to the Ferris Gallery, so I was aware of his artwork from about 1962 on.
Wow, okay, so I know in 62 he kind of experimented, right, with other mediums.
In 62 he starts, that's what the one of his first exhibitions, or the one that really catapults him or sets off the rocket, is the Ferris Gallery show of the Camel Soup Cans.
Oh, that's okay.
62 in L.A. He showed at the Stables Gallery, but it's the Camel Soup Cans that really launched him as far as publicity and people taking notice, because they were so shocked that a painting of a Campbell soup can could be art. That's still controversial to this day for certain people. Andy changed the way we look at art in American culture and culture internationally.
I totally. And wasn't there like another place down the street? Like you can buy the cans for like 20 cents. Like, why are you buying?
Right. So I think somebody, because people mocked Andy at that point, but. And what he was doing is he was representing what our culture is about, and this is why the Europeans, especially the Germans, really bought the pop artists, you know, Lichtenstein, Andy, Rosenquist, and others. They, you know, it's post-war economy, and they didn't have it, so they could buy, they couldn't have the mass consumer culture that we had here in the United States, so they bought the paintings and put them on their walls in lieu of that.
Right, and I think he was also saying that, you know, especially with Campbell Soup, that embodies sort of nourishment, right? And embodies, like, what he grew up, what his mother would feed him every day.
Yeah, I mean, I think he wrote about it in maybe Popism or whatever, but yeah, he used to have Campbell Soup every day for in his early days. Andy came from a very poor family, so...
Right, So the interviews I've seen, with his brothers, Paul and John, mm-hmm. I know they said that, you know, he definitely, their mother had a really, really good supply. Basically, Campbell's Soup and Hershey bars, like
right.
Two very iconic.
But his mother, Julia, was the inspiration for him to become an artist. She really encouraged him to draw and was, you know, a real muse for him. He had the talent and the magic, and she recognized that, and she encouraged him. So he was, if you see Andy's early drawings from even pre-college, they're pretty extraordinary for his age.
Yeah, and also, like, I think, like, I when I went to the Warhol Museum, I got the privilege of going after 20 years, like, basically 20 years. It was a dream of mine. I went, and I saw,
oh,
like,
right.
I was so excited. I did a screen test. Was that camera used at the screen test, the actual camera he used? Was it that?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, because that's he had, I think it was a 16 millimeter Beaulieu at that point. No. It's in the spirit of what they do there, which is great because it's like 3 minutes long. You enjoyed it.
I was just watching it today, and it's almost a year now that I did that. And as you're aware, I believe you're aware that I interviewed his nephew Donald. And
yes, you mentioned that.
And I think
nice guy.
He's an amazing guy, super nice guy. And I wanted to get your take on Andy because I know that. You know, obviously, you worked with him for close to 20 years. He trusted you, like, unlike anybody else, from what I gather from the documentaries I've watched. And also, if I'm not mistaken, he made you an executor of his estate, right?
I was one of, well, Fred Hughes, his business manager and really close friend. Fred was the executor. I was the backup executor in the event something happened to Fred. But there were three of us in the will. It was Fred Hughes, myself, and John Warhola. And in the will, we were instructed to create a foundation for the advancement of the visual arts, a charitable foundation for the advancement of the visual arts. So we had to define what that is because Andy, as far as death was a very abstract thought to him. And so he left it out. He left it to us to start the foundation and define it for, you know, what foundation it was because you have all these IRS rules. So Fred Hughes took the lead on that. And unfortunately, Fred became severely ill with MS soon after Andy's death. So it was you couldn't write a book. It's such an incredibly sad story of Fred's.
That is very sad.
Physically, because you know, here was if you said something and you wrote it was fiction, they would say it was too extreme, but it's actually all true.
Oh my God, that's unbelievable. And I know that you and Fred, especially after the attempted assassination, you, Fred, and Bob Colicello were basically the ones like, and please tell me if I'm wrong, sort of. The main guys in Andy's life in terms of his business life that were sort of running the show. And I know before that there were a lot of like speed freaks and drag queens and stuff and drug addicts basically at the factory who were, you know, giving him phenomenal ideas and inspiration, but obviously they weren't good for him.
Well, that depends on who you're talking about. I mean, a lot of those... So I was never at the Silver Factory, and that's where most people think of Andy because that was the parties, and that's where all the speed was and stuff. When I came around, so Fred Hughes and Paul Morrissey were Andy's managers up until 1974, and then Paul leaves, and then Fred really takes over the exclusive business manager position. I was made vice president of Andy Warhol Enterprises around 1974. And Bob ran Interview Magazine. So, yeah, we were three. But the ascendancy of the drag queens really starts in the early 70s when there's, quote, the second wave of people working with Andy, which Bob, me, Glenn O'Brien, others, you know, worked for Interview Magazine. But Andy was a very intuitive person, the most intuitive man I ever met. So he knew by hiring me that he could trust me. And so I helped run the business. Fred, you know, organized the exhibitions and worked on painting sales. I got into print publishing with Andy to organize those deals. And then I eventually produced all his TV shows and video work.
That's incredible. So like Andy Warhol TV and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, so we went to broadcast quality equipment the end of 1979, and I hired a guy named Don Monroe to direct, and Andy, I produced, and Andy executive produced and became the host of his own show. So we, at the time of his death, we had a series on MTV called Andy Warhol's 15 Minutes. It was the first long format show because it wasn't 15 minutes. It was a half hour long. that was something Andy was very happy about. And was at the time of his death, which we didn't know was going to happen, it was so unexpected. I had optioned Slaves in New York to do a film, and Andy and I would have executive produced that movie. And then I wanted Andy to get back into filmmaking and to expand the video department that I was building. But everything changed that fateful weekend.
Wow, that's, I mean...
upside down.
Totally rocked the world upside down.
So how did you get involved with watches?
Well, I started in the watch industry when I was like 13. My dad used to own the world's largest store for Swatch watches in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of... It's interesting because that's where I think I really first heard Andy Warhol's name. And I heard at that time, this was like this must have been late 80s, early 90s, so a few years after Andy's death, that, you know, at one time, I don't know if this is true or not, but Andy was going to collaborate with Swatch or something like that.
Swatch, I think, took some ads in an interview, and Swatch Company wanted Andy to design a watch. But Andy was very reticent about doing that, and we also had a company called North American Watch Company, that corporation that we were working with. The head of it was Jerry Grinberg, and that was Piaget, Coram, Concord. And
I know exactly. I remember it. I remember that. Five watches came up.
Yeah, and then Andy suggested to the Swatch people, liking them very much, he suggested that Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf do Swatch watches.
Artists.
And Andy stepped back from that. But then Andy, in fact, I have one. He would do promotions with Swatch. So I have an old Swatch watch that's never been out of its plastic package.
No
Andy
way.
Signed. So he signed. That's what he would sign them, and then they would hand them out as promotion.
No way. That's incredible.
Andy was very supportive. So Andy, as you know, loved watches. So
absolutely, absolutely. Donald sent me a list of all. He had 200 watches in his collection. For all of those of you out there who don't know this, and this is kind of, I mean, it's public information, but it's kind of privileged information as well, because not many people know this, that Andy was a massive watch collector. I mean, he had some of the best watches in the world, from Jaeger old LeCoultres to Rolexes to Cartiers to Bulova's, kinds.
Yeah, he had a gold Rolex. He had Cartier watches. He had many kinds of Rolex. He gave me like a Rolex from the 50s, which I wore a few times and it broke, and then I got it fixed and it broke again, so I keep it as a object.
Memento. That's amazing. That's awesome.
We got watches. Then we also got watches from North American Watch. So I had Movado watches, and but Andy really, and that's how we became very good friends with Jerry Grinberg and the people working at North American Watch, which is now called Movado Group.
Movado Group. Right.
And Jerry Grinberg's son Ephraim Grinberg runs the company.
That's correct. That's correct. And I believe, was Jerry the one who bought Andy's cookie jar collection?
Yes, he did. He bought pretty much every lot. There were, I don't know, I forget how many lots, but I think he got every lot with exceptions of maybe two or three tops. So he knew what he was doing, because he bought every lot after lot, which was the whole value at Sotheby's at that time for all the cookie jars, which is maybe 200 cookie plus the cookie jars. It was like $8,000. Or $8,000 to $10,000 estimate. So it sold, I think, altogether for something like $285,000.
Yes, I heard or read it was like $250,000.
Jerry Grinberg was, or Hidalgo in Spanish, was very shrewd and smart by buying most of them and keeping the whole collection together. They became an art piece. So he was able to do a book. He got all this publicity in, you know, the major magazines in the country. You can pay a marketing firm to do anything better than that.
That's massive. And I know that also Andy was, he was in a way almost like a pack rat, from what I understand. Like, he just collected stuff.
He was a shopaholic.
Right. And he had like Navajo blankets and all sorts of things that he collected and just kept them in their shopping bags with the original receipts.
Well, some of them, some things he didn't, some things he didn't. I mean, Jed Johnson, who was his boyfriend for many years, decorated his house at 57 East 66th Street with amazing furniture. And, if you look at the thing to do for people, if they can find it, is to look at the Sotheby's catalogs, his collection that we sold at auction at Sotheby's in 1988, 89.
Right.
And you'll see the vast collection of beautiful collectibles, furniture, artwork of other artists. It's extraordinary. But he really liked to shop every day.
Yeah, and he wanted deals too, right? Like he.
Yep.
He liked
to negotiate, and if he wasn't doing it, he'd have me do it, or Fred, or Jed.
So, Vincent, did you feel like you, in a way, did you feel like, in a lot of ways, you were kind of his voice? Because I know that he was kind of, you know, from what I understand, and of course, please tell me if I'm wrong, I'm just going by what I've seen, I don't know what's real and what's not real, but I know from what I've seen of you, obviously it's real, but like, you know, he was definitely very awkward and shy, and he grew up with sort of an Asperger's type syndrome. That's what.
Well, that's what people say. That's never been confirmed to me. And he was very shy, but in public, he had a public persona and a private persona. The private persona was he was a good conversationalist. But he also was a great listener. His public persona was to be quiet, you know, silent, and he liked to play the village idiot to pretend like it's a kind of a smokescreen. He knew a lot more than people, but that he let on to people, I should say. So, you know, but if you were working on, let's say, the books like Pat Hackett, the philosophy book that Bridget Berlin, Bob Colicello, and Pat Hackett worked on.
Right.
Pat Hackett, who co-wrote Popism, she wrote it, he talked to her. But you have to think like Andy thinks and write like his thoughts are. So you become Andy for that moment in time. I never did any collaborations with any of his writing. I worked on the TV shows and television work. But again, once he trusted you, he allowed you a lot of freedom to interpret on his behalf.
Right, to extend his thoughts.
But if he didn't like it, he'd certainly let you know.
And, I mean, not to get into this, because I want this to be a positive show. I don't really want to focus on the negative at all. I think it's just interesting that, you know, I like from what I've seen in the interviews, even with Paul Morrissey, it seems like there was definitely some sort of, I don't know, jealousy or rivalry. I have no idea. It just seems like the way Paul talked about Andy is not very forgiving.
I think it's unfortunate because I like Paul very much, and Paul worked with Andy for quite a few years, but he went away. I mean, it's kind of revisionist history. Now Paul rants against Andy's wasn't intelligent, was not creative.
Right.
Which is not true.
Right.
At all. It's just,
right.
Unfortunately, Paul's very, you know, his opinions become stronger and stronger. Paul was less strident about Andy right after Andy died, as you can see in the Museum of Modern Art retrospective catalog. We all gave quotes or, you know, did something. Bridget and I interviewed each other about Andy, but Paul's little section in the back of that catalog is much more kinder, and it's just over the last 20 years or so, it's just all he does is trash Andy, which is not what their relationship
was. It's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. It's not. It doesn't make Paul look good because, you know, he can't say that Andy was not talented and didn't do anything. It's not true.
And I know he's incredibly creative. I mean, I know that he did direct those movies and Trash and the other ones.
Well,
and
yeah, no one's ever said Paul's not the director. Andy even said that. Andy never took credit Andy was presenting Flesh, Trash, and Heat as producer. Not the director. Those are Paul's movies.
Right.
And all the movies that Paul has done, no one's ever said they're not Paul's movies. I don't know why he gets so crazy. Andy's name's above the title because he's presents. It's Andy Warhol's Frankenstein. It's Paul's movie.
Right, right, right.
Frankenstein and Dracula are Paul's movies, and Andy would never said it was his movie.
That's unbelievable. I wish him only the best. I mean, I think
I do
that.
Too. I haven't talked to Paul in a long time, but he does. He spends more time trashing Andy than talking about himself, which is too bad.
And you know
he's
what?
Promoting what he's doing.
Absolutely, and I know, like, from the sale, I think from the proceeds of one of the movies, they both bought a house in Montauk, and I know he sold it for a lot of money.
Yeah, that and see, Paul benefited by being associated with Andy because. Paul sold, you know, they bought the house after Trash. The house in Montauk was bought the end of 71, the beginning of 72, I think for like about $250,000.
Oh, my God.
Paul was 50% owner, and after Andy died, we knew, Fred and I knew, that Paul wouldn't sell his half. So the Andy Warhol Foundation gave Paul 5 acres in the houses as his share, and the other 15 acres went to the conservancy, whatever it was called out there. They did a nature trail. So Paul got the best part of the deal, got 5 acres for protection, protected by wetlands and the houses, which he then sold, you know, 10 years later for roughly, at that time, around $28, $30 million. I think.
Oh, my God. Today it would probably be $2 million, right?
Well, it's been resold. It just got sold again. But the fact is that I'm happy for Paul for all that. That's incredible.
Absolutely.
That's great. So he should be happy that Andy bought the house with him.
Yeah, and he should be happy that he was associated with, you know.
And the fact that people went to the house because of Andy. He doesn't, you know, he always talks about it as just his place. The draw was Andy Warhol. I'm sorry. The Rolling Stones and different people like that came, Mick Jagger by himself. They came to stay there primarily because of Andy.
That's just unbelievable. Did you ever get to meet, by the way, not to like get off topic, but did you ever get to meet the late David Bowie?
Yes, I did. When he first came to meet Andy, when we were still at 33 Union Square West, Michael Netter was doing videotapes, and I was working with Michael, and we taped David Bowie's first meeting with Andy.
That's incredible. Yeah, and I know David Bowie did a song.
Yeah, roughly 1972. Yeah.
What a great time period, Vincent. I know you were there. I mean, during the Studio 54 era, which was basically more or less the CBGB's era, and then you had rap coming in, and
don't forget the Mud Club.
The Mud Club, and like the most, in my opinion, pop culture as we know it today was invented during that time period in New York City. And the worst time as far as economics go.
Well,
and
in the 70s, New York was on the verge of bankruptcy. But, you know, I didn't have any money in the 70s, and we were all young. We all had a good time, and it makes people very inventive and creative. If you're creative, you invent things. And there were certainly a lot of wealthy people in the city. So New York City itself was crumbling, but there was a great variety of people from very poor to very rich, and they all commingled in the arts area. And there was, you know, there were a lot of really great people. And then the advent of AIDS, really, we lost a lot of good people in New York.
A ton.
Starting around 1981, that's the first. So, yeah, so it's, you know, you live long enough, you have a lot of memories, don't you?
Well, definitely.
I was lucky enough just to be working with one of the great artists of the 20th century, so.
I think the most important artist, you know, I know they say the first half belongs to Picasso and the second half belongs to Andy. But in my mind, when I look at everything, it's so much deeper than you think. You know, I mean, it evokes a spirit and he's my inspiration. Honestly, I told this to Donald when I interviewed him that everything I do more or less is Warholized. And people are like, is that a term? And I'm like, well, it's my term.
No, you've made it. Well, it's now yours. Yeah, you own it. But I think that the two biggest names of the 20th century for most people, and that can be argued, would be Picasso and Andy.
Definitely.
They're the two names that are always tossed around. Because it's not just what you paint and what you create. It's also how you influence the world around you and the culture around you.
And I know that like a lot of people ask, what was Andy's inspiration? Wasn't it Duchamp?
Well, Andy was very well versed in art history. So Duchamp was certainly somebody that passed the baton to Andy. They understood each other. I mean, Andy was a conceptual artist as well as a pop artist. He was a colorist. He was an installation artist. So it was, he lived and breathed art, and, you know, even his appearance was part of his art.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know. His wigs were, like, part of who he was. I mean, he had so many different kinds of wigs and so many different colors, from white to yellow to, you know, like blinding.
They were never particularly yellow. The main differences were there were different shades of white going from night to day or day to night.
Right.
And then he became a male model in 1980, and he cut his wig shorter. Those are the differences.
And then didn't he dye the back black? I remember seeing an interview.
The
back was dark, and I know that you, Bridget, and Bob are still very much friends, and you talk to each other. How is everybody doing? I mean, is everybody really, like, I mean...
We're still all good friends. Bridget is now 76 and is a recluse staying in her apartment all the time, watching Fox News 24/7. Bob is, you know, writing for Vanity Fair. He's, I think, one of the best writers they've had. And he's still writing the second volume of his Reagan book. And unfortunately, you know, Mrs. Reagan just passed away. So I haven't talked to him since that. So I'll probably speak to him next week.
That's incredible. And
I have remained friends all those years.
And that's awesome. One day, well, actually, Vincent, I'll be in New York, you know, for my 40th birthday celebration. My cousin owns an apartment around behind the Flatiron Building. And I don't know if you'll be around. I'm sure you're a busy man. But if you are, I'd love to grab a coffee with you, just put a name to a face and see if we can meet up. If not, I totally understand. But it would be an honor for me.
Email me when you're coming around. We'll see what we can do.
Absolutely. And do you, and I noticed in some of the interviews I've seen you with, you were wearing a Breitling Navitimer. Am I correct about that?
A what?
A Breitling? Is it a Breitling Navitimer?
Oh, you are. Oh, yeah. Good eyes.
That's what I do. So this is my business, and I was immediately like, okay, like it seems that Vincent has very classic taste, and I'm not a huge fan of Breitling watches, to be honest. But the Navitimer is the only Breitling I would ever wear.
What watch do you wear?
I wear a Tudor, which is owned by Rolex.
Oh, nice.
Yep.
Well, aren't you fancy? No, this one was given to me. This one was given to me by a friend, and then I got used to wearing it. I have a number of watches, but then, I don't have. I have one that somebody left from the 70s, which was a Movado, but I think I have to get the bracelet part fixed. It was a stainless steel one, which was a nice one, but it's so indicative of the period.
Yeah, because
anyway, I have to go. So good talking to you. And
pleasure.
Email me when you come into New York.
What a really interesting gentleman Vincent Fremont is. That was awesome, and I really appreciate his insight. It totally is completing this circle that I have that I'm trying to. I don't know where I'm going with this journey and search for who Andy Warhol was, but every time I do an interview like this, whether it's his nephew Donald or Vincent, who was incredibly close to him, almost a confidant and an incredibly trusted business colleague. It just makes me want to search even deeper and more, because there's a real person behind the artist, and a lot of people most people didn't get to see it. And what I like about, you know, both these interviews is that, you know, obviously the family saw they saw Andy for who he was, the child that they, you know, the brothers saw, and of course the nephews and nieces saw their uncle and got family time, and then of course Vincent was privy to a lot of the business dealings and a lot of, you know, joint ventures and collaborations and you know, being part of some incredibly important historic eras in American pop culture. And you know, today Vincent is with Art News, which has been printing art magazines since the 1920s. I'm incredibly grateful to Vincent for giving me his time, and I really look forward to meeting him, should I have the opportunity, when I'm in New York at the end of next month. I'd like to thank Shalboy Music and DJ Flipside for providing the musical tracks to this podcast. If you want to know what's going on with me and the watch industry, check out my Instagram and my Twitter. My handles for both are at AmitDaveHonda. You can also check out my Facebook watch page. Don't forget to like it. I want to thank all of you who support my podcast and listen to it. It means a lot. And if you listen to this and you like it, please, you know, on whether it's iTunes that you're listening to it on, or Google Play, or whether you're listening to it directly on Podbean, which hosts this podcast, please don't forget to like it, because I do this for myself, of course. It's very cathartic, but I also do it for you. And I love sharing these moments in my life, because they're very important to me. And I love sharing any news that I have watch-related, but also pop culture related, and I think this is a very important one. So thank you very much for that. Definitely you sign up for my weekly newsletter. I'll be sure to include the link. And until we meet again, rock on and fly back.